Y'all pay attention to this. This may be the most you get out of this entire workshop. This is Cowboy's Guide to Life. Timing has a lot to do with the outcome of a rain dance. There's more ways to skin a cat than sticking his head in a boot jack and jerking on his tail. After weeks of beans and taters, even a change to taters and beans is good. Some ranchers raise pigs and some even admit it. Either way, they're raising pigs. After eating an entire bull, a mountain lion felt so good, he started roaring. He kept it up until a hunter came along and shot him. The moral, when you're full of bull, keep your mouth shut. The easiest way to eat crows while it's still warm. The colder it gets, the harder it is to swallow. If you find yourself in a hole, first thing to do is stop digging. Never smack a man when he's chewing tobacco. It don't take a genius to spot a goat in a flock of sheep. Never ask a barber if he thinks you need a haircut. If you get into thinking you're a person of some influence, try ordering somebody else's dog around. A woman's heart's like a campfire. If you don't tend to it regular, you'll soon lose it. If you're riding ahead of the herd, take a look back every now and then. Make sure it's still there. No matter where you ride to, that's where you are. Remember, even a kick in the caboose is a step forward. There's two theories to arguing with a woman. Neither one works. And here's the only one that applies to this workshop. If you work for a man, ride for his brand. Treat his cattle as if they were your own. This little book's entitled Don't Squat With Your Spurs On. Long ago at a navigator staff conference, Lauren Sandy pointed out that to a group of rookie navigators people who are serious about following Christ would be known as servants, but none of us want to be treated like servants. We have natural opportunities to learn servanthood. Can y'all hear me okay?
No.
Fair? No? Got a deal.
Eric, just do it.
They may not be able to hear it. We can hear it.
We can. That doesn't last very long either, though, does it? 10 minutes? Y'all might want to turn around a little bit. No, but I'm not sure that it's a small group that's going to work like a small group. Y'all get comfortable. Some of the natural opportunities we have is to learn servanthood as children. We had that opportunity, especially when there were as many as five or more in a family. You have a better chance of learning it the more kids you've got. Another place that you had the opportunity to learn servanthood was as a freshman in high school, especially if you got involved in team sports. Your first summer job you might have had, if you were a part-timer on a crew of full-time folks, you might have had a chance to learn servanthood there. As new husbands you do, as new fathers you do, and maybe you were in the military and you might have had a chance to learn it there too. Interestingly, though, the thing that I learned in those situations is that I didn't want to be a servant. And the quicker I did the best I could, the less serving I'd have to do. That the important thing is to gain rank. I always thought that the prospect of being boss was best. And that's why I went to college. Is that why y'all went to college? Did everybody go to college? Maybe you didn't, but still, wouldn't you rather be boss? That was always kind of my goal. I'm a light sleeper. The hardest thing I had to do when my first child was born was to play like I was still asleep when she woke up crying. As a second-born son, I noticed in a hurry that if I could outdo my brothers by having a good attitude and working hard at jobs that they didn't like. And so when I was 14, I got charge of the family farm. I got to be the big guy. And I moved up from rank by being a willing servant. And I learned I could take it over, see. I learned the best way to impress coaches, though, in team sports was through athletic ability, not serving. So to heck with them, because I wasn't good enough to make the A team in 5A ball. So that's that deal. That's not a good place to learn serving. But in summer jobs, I gladly took menial tasks when I was a rookie because I learned in a hurry that a good attitude toward those things gave me an opportunity to advance. I also noticed that the foreman hated getting in bad with the full-time guys, so it was easier for him to ask one of the part-time guys, and I always volunteered, and so soon I got special treatment and special assignments. When I got married, though, that was a problem. My wife is pretty much of a natural when it comes to serving, and so I knew my marriage wouldn't help me be a servant because I could always just kind of give her the job. In 1970, my first assignment with the Navigators, preparing for that was very stressful for me because I was around guys who were smarter than I was, who were better able to do the job. They had greater capacity and more gifted, so I didn't have a chance to get favored status with those guys. But I did notice that with a box full of tools, I could do stuff that they couldn't do, and I could still find favor. And so from time to time when I'd travel, I'd carry a box full of tools. And every place I went had something to do there. In 1971, I came up to Oklahoma City to get a new bird dog pup from Gene War, and I had my tools. And he'd just gotten carpet in the back end of his house. He used to call that his profit chamber in those days. Now he's got a guest house. But he just got new carpet, and I noticed that all the doors were dragging the carpet because the guys who installed it didn't cut off the doors to accommodate. And y'all know Jack Combs probably. He taught me how to cut off doors and cut them off right and cut them off where you don't splinter the veneer. So I just did that for old Gene. And interestingly, I was carrying the door out the front. I had these portable sawhorses I brought, and I set my shop up out in his driveway, and Lauren Sandy drove up, and he was visiting Gene there for the weekend, and there I was cutting doors, and he was proud that I was on his team, man. In fact, he invited me to come to his house. I never got... See? That's because the Bible says, do you see a man skilled in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before obscure men. The problem was, this didn't teach me to be a servant. It just taught me how I could gain favor in situations. In 1974, I was studying 1 Peter with a guy that used to fly bombing missions in Vietnam, and he was back from that, and we were doing this study, and we got to the part on servanthood, and we concluded that we would probably never be servants. So I had a little dab of walnut out in my shop, and we went out there after we discussed Bible study, and I made me a servant heart. And here it is. It's a solid walnut servant heart, and I even carved the letters on there and blacked the letters in. I'd pass it around, but I'm afraid somebody'd steal it from me, because these are a valuable commodity. I showed this to Gene War soon after that, and he said, well, that's good to know, Charlie. If anybody ever asks if you've got a servant heart, I can tell them, yeah, you do, because I've seen it. But I figure that's the only way I really would ever get one. That same year, I took my family to Illinois. And at that time, my daughter was about about eight, my son was three, and Dad had a new airplane he was proud of, and so he wanted to fly us to Iowa City, where my younger brother was going to college working on a PhD from Galesburg, Illinois. And coming back, it was hot, and those two little kids sitting back there, and my son lost it. See, and Dad and I are real sensitive about that. And so he was finding an airport first chance he could and put it down and went after towels. And so he, being a better servant than me, and besides that, it was his airplane, he took charge to clean that mess. Because I don't do stuff like that, see. That's, I don't quite, and I can still see him backing into that, reaching back behind that deal, wiping it up, just gagging, see. But at least he was a servant. I couldn't have done that. However, in 75, a potent virus came through, and it was cycling. My daughter had already had it, and we were on family vacation, staying in a pop-up camper that we borrowed from a friend. And by this, it was a real potent virus. My daughter ended up with spinal meningitis with it. But before she got, there was my son. We're in the middle of our camp out, him standing in the middle of that trailer, and he had a blowout. I mean, it was bad. And he was standing in this dark green, black puddle of the most rotten, smelly stuff I'd ever seen. And where's Mom? Where is Kay? She and my daughter were on a nature walk. My word, what are we going to do now? Because I don't do stuff like that, see? And as I was cleaning the little fella up and just praying, loving the guy, feeling sorry for him and myself too, thanking God that I might yet have a chance to become a servant, maybe. In 1977 or 78, maybe you remember, some of you, Agape Records or somebody like that came through peddling records, and they had the Fruit of the Spirit in little songs, neat little songs, and one of the songs was, if you want to be great in God's kingdom, you must be servant of all. And that's the only phrase in the song. It's a beautiful and a catchy tune, and it's made from one of Jesus's leadership training sessions with his men, isn't it? But is that right? If you want to be great in God's kingdom, you must be servant of all. What's the emphasis? There's something that's wrong with that. The goal is being great. Does anybody here want to be great? Does anybody here not want to be great? I don't want to be great. Is that the way you feel? I don't want to be great. You want to be great? You want to be great in God's kingdom? Well, then what you need to do is serve, and that'll make you great. And that's the wrong emphasis. And that was the exact motivation. That's why I don't think I'll be a servant ever, because I'll never get that figured out, that serving has to do with helping God, working for God, doing things that he wants us to do to help others. So it's not how great you are, it's how many people you help. See, that's the point. And that's why I'll never be a servant. Because servanthood has to do with sanctification. Tell me what you think of when you think of sanctification. What is sanctification? What do you think? What's set apart? Somebody says set apart. That's what it means. Holy comes from the same word. You see the word holy in your English text. It comes from the same deal. To be holy, to be sanctified, set apart. That is, you all know Romans 8:28, for we know that in everything, I messed it up already for myself. We know that in everything God works. Somebody help me with that one. Everything works for good. Of him. And what's his purpose? It's in the next verse. Yeah, to make us look like, to conform us to the image of Jesus, to look like Jesus. That's sanctification. And one of the situations of servanthood is that it helps us look like him, because the reason that I don't serve you more than I do is because I have my own agenda, and I really don't have time for that and to achieve my own agenda. Do you understand what I'm saying? I don't love you any more than I do because I love myself too much, and there's not enough to go around. If I'm going to achieve my goals, if I'm going to achieve the significance that I want, the security that I want, and achieve the sense of success that I desire, and enhance my career the way I want to, and I'm going to feel a sense of honor, I can't take time to serve you because I've got this agenda to do this. And that's my problem. The biggest problem that Jesus has in sanctifying me is to set me apart from myself, from my own selfish agenda. Does that make sense? And so that's why I wonder if I'll ever be a servant. Sanctify, set apart. What words come to mind when you think of the word servant? Let's just say words. Assistant. What's some others?
Helper.
Sacrifice.
Giver.
Wash feet.
Humility.
Others
better than yourself.
Slave. Is slave in there? Slave. Companion. What'd you say?
Love.
Jesus, apprentice, deputy, subordinate, custodian, warden, manager. This is interesting. Gets into manager, an administrator, supervisor, dean, executive, superintendent, guardian, trustee. These guys are servants, aren't they? Aren't they servants? Aren't they stewards? We have elected public officials, and they are our public servants. Yes, they are, aren't they? We've all got an idea of what it is, and we don't like it, do we? That's why we went to college. We wanted to get away from that kind of a menial task deal. When I was part-time, I didn't mind doing those menial tasks because I knew that when I got out of college, that wasn't all that I'd have to do. I could do something better than these guys. See, I wouldn't have to be a servant. Because it's contrary to my basic suppositions about life and what I'm trying to achieve. I had hoped that we would have a workshop because the fact is I'm not good at for an hour and a half lecture, and that's what we're kind of scheduled for. I noticed our small groups, the small group in this corner over here on the left was as big as the whole room over there, so I'm a little defeated in the thing that I wanted to do. I wanted to give you all a chance to handle the scripture. What we want to do right now is to refresh ourselves. We kind of know what we've got an idea of servanthood and the evolution and why I'm not one. So what is it that the Bible says a servant is? That we could refresh ourselves in what that is and then figure out what that looks like in real life, and maybe you can help me anyway. Genesis 1:28 is sometimes called the cultural mandate. It's the first mandate that God placed on mankind. It's a general thing. Some people call it the dominion mandate. Does anybody know what that one is? It says, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it, doesn't it? And have dominion over the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and the beasts of the field, whatever moves on the earth, every living creature. The reason that that's where I want to start is to refresh us in the fact that we are put here not to own or to amass dominion, but to be stewards. The original intent of God for us was to be caretakers of what He owns. And all that we do with regard to earning a living and plowing or whatever you do, if you raise tomatoes in greenhouses. This has to do with this mandate. And we're stewards. We're not owners. We've got a responsibility for this. That's where civil government fits in. We have a stewardship of our country. And these things fit in. But I want to talk just a second about it. Just two areas that fit in this stewardship. And what I want to talk about is time and material possessions. My time is God's time. If it wasn't for me, God wouldn't even need time. Time is not for Him. He's ageless and eternal. He doesn't need that. We do. We need time. And my time belongs to God. Colossians 3:23-24, whatever your task, work heartily, serving the Lord and not men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive an inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. Now, the fact that that I don't earn a living like you do, and I'm not ashamed of that, and I don't want any of you all to feel bad that all I do all day is read my Bible and visit with close friends, just about. And I don't want you to feel bad about that, that you're not that way. I don't feel bad about it. But when you go to work, your time is just as much God's time as my time. When I lay out my agenda for the day, I'm always, of course, God, what do you want me to, how do you want to fill this? What do you want me to do with these hours? But that's your responsibility too, because that time is God's time. The Bible doesn't have a category of this is sacred and this is secular. It's all God's, isn't it? Would you all agree with that?
Yes.
And then how about your material possessions? Are they God's? The Bible's pretty clear about my money. Haggai 2:8 says, the silver is mine and the gold is mine, says the Lord of hosts. In fact, here's some little verses about money. It's interesting. God gives money the ability to do different things, it seems. In Haggai 1:9-11, you hope for much, but get so little. And when you bring it home, I blow it away. God just kind of blows on it. Whoosh. It doesn't last at all. Why? Because my temple lies in ruins and you don't care. Your only concern is your own fine homes. Ecclesiastes 5:10-11 says, he who loves money will never have enough. The foolishness of thinking that wealth brings happiness. The more you have, the more you spend, right up to the limits of your income. So what is the advantage of wealth except to perhaps watch it as it runs through your fingers? God can blow on it, or maybe you can see it run through your fingers. Proverbs 23:5, don't weary yourself trying to get rich. Why waste our time? For riches can disappear as though they had the wings of a bird. Now we've got disappearing acts of money. And sometimes it goes through holes in your pockets too. How about our TVs and our couches and our beds and our bedsteads and our living room suits and our bedroom suits and our Belch Fire 8s and all our material possessions? Whose are those? Our farms, our houses, our businesses. Who owns those?
God.
The bank. I had a feed business 4 years, and it was 100% leveraged, and the banker's name was Griffin Lord. I thought it was Lord Griffin. Because it was, as a matter of fact. I was his slave there, wasn't I? The banks. How important is it that you and I go through our little estates and say, God, this is yours. Am I using this Am I a steward? Am I an owner? Is this yours or is this mine? My time is yours. My material possessions are yours. What are some things that we learn about servanthood from this, just this line of thinking? Servanthood is stewardship, isn't it? Did you pick up anything else that we need to mention about servanthood? Stewardship, not owners, stewards. What's the requirement of stewards? How do we know that? 1 Corinthians 4:2, isn't it? The requirement of stewards is that we be found faithful. Let's look at another servant passage. Timothy is an example of a servant. I wish I was like that. Paul highly commends Timothy. In 1 Thessalonians 2, about verse 4 or 5, he calls Timothy God's fellow worker. Isn't that something? Timothy was so surrendered to God that he was, one of the ways that he was described is as God's fellow worker. Paul says this to the Philippians in Philippians 2, verse 20 and following. I have no one like him who will be genuinely anxious for your welfare. They all look after their own interests, not those of Christ. But Timothy's worth you know, for as a son with the Father, he has served me with the gospel. I hope therefore to send him just as soon as I see how it will go with me. And I trust that in the Lord that shortly I myself will come. Verse 30 says, for he nearly died, and this is another servant, Epaphroditus, he nearly died for the work of Christ. This man risked his life. And so what can we learn when we think of a servant? What is a servant? We had some descriptive words. How does the Bible describe a servant? What are his character qualities? What does he do? What are the activities of a servant? Kind of this be no do thing. What are his skills? That's what he knows and how to do. What are his activities? What does he do? What does he look like? What is his character? How would you describe Timothy in this situation? What are some descriptive words that you can think of from that passage?
Available.
Faithful.
Teachable.
Fat man, huh? Know what fat is? Faithful, available, and teachable. I'm glad it works. Fat's in, guys. Fat's in. Faithful, available, and teachable. He put the interests of others above his own. I think you mentioned that in our kindred spirit. Like as a son serves his father, he was in. Pardon me?
Identification.
Servant becomes very identified with the person whom you serve.
Good point. Excellent point. Any others? We covered some roles. Available. He traveled. He worked. He functioned. Good.
I think one of the things there on Timothy is he says, I have no man like-minded with naturally characteristic just like I was. So Timothy was a servant carrying out the heart and the spirit of Paul's ministry as if it was his own. Doing it for the Lord.
That's awesome. Have any of you ever seen that happen in your experience? I'm not that way, really. I've had trouble, conflict with my superiors over that in time. So I want to have an agenda too, and I want to look like somebody. I want talk about this identification. I want to look like me. I don't want to look like somebody else. Yes, sir?
A good servant would seem to me to want to see his supervisor or his leader, whoever it is, succeed. Not only just identify the goals, but work at someone else's success. So that a good servant would be invested in the boss's success.
Yes. Yes, sir.
My dad was that kind of man. He's retired now, but he invested his whole life in helping another man succeed. And he was his assistant for over 40 years. And he modeled for me that kind of servant. He was the kind of person that didn't care who got the credit, just so the job got done.
Mm. It's amazing. Has anybody done?
My first conference after my young Christian, I guess I was about a month old in the Lord, was in Lakey, Texas at H.E. Gutter Mansion. I went in, I was in the Navy at the time, and I threw my gear on the bottom bunk. Then this old guy came in and kind of climbed up the top bunk. And we got to talking about having some big terrible problem, and I got to talking to him about it. Now, not only did they make me go to this conference, but I had to wash dishes too. And so I said, well, I've got to wash dishes. They said, well, I'll go over with you. And I was washing and he was drying. And then the music came and I figured they were going to have a skit there. So that was the only fun I was going to have out of this conference, because all I did was want to pray and talk about the Bible. And I knew I wasn't going to finish up before the meeting because I was behind. And this guy said, well, you go ahead to the meeting and I'll finish up here. And then they announced the speaker. And he comes out of the kitchen and dries off his hands for all night. So he's there, Jim Down.
Is that right?
Charlie, I've never forgotten that.
Yeah.
And I've always said, you know, I want to be the kind of guy that does that kind of thing. So he had to work all the time. But it was a good model. And I've seen very few models like that.
Yeah. That's right. That's, if you aspire to be a servant, I want you to know the competition is not real great. You'll have you've got a good chance of making that one. Let's look at another familiar passage, Luke 19. We could go to several of the Gospels with this one. I'm going to start in verse 13. Calling 10 of his servants, he gave them 10 pounds and said to them, trade with these till I come. But his citizens hated him and sent an embassy after him, saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. When he returned, having received the kingdom, he commanded those servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him. Did everybody get the reverence? It's Luke 19. I'm in 16 now. When he returned, having received the kingdom, he commanded these servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him, that he might know what they had gained by trading. The first came before him, saying, Lord, your pound has made 10 pounds more. He said to him, well done, good servant. Because you have been faithful in a very little, you shall have authority over 10 cities. And the second one came, saying, Lord, your pound has made 5 pounds. And he said to him, you are to be over 5 cities. Then another came, saying, Lord, here's your pound, which I have kept laid away in a napkin, for I was afraid. And you know the rest of that story. What are some of the characteristics of a servant in this one that you see? So what does a servant look like? What are his activities?
What is himself?
Pardon me?
Thought for himself within the guidelines of the big picture that he had been given.
Okay, initiative?
He had initiative.
He took initiative, he planned, he thought through the thing, planned, figured out what was required of him.
Took action.
Anything else? How is faithfulness described. Everybody seemed like made the formations, didn't they? The faithful were the ones that earned what was expected. Is that right? There was production in that deal? Yes, sir.
To accept and complete an assignment.
He accepted and completed an assignment, right? Right. Any other qualities? Yes, sir.
He had a respect for what was somebody else's.
Respected what was somebody else's.
Instead of disrespect for what was his.
Right. Yes, sir.
No limitations. The man with five made five. He didn't make 15 or 20.
Hmm.
And I think part of servanthood is knowing limitations so that we don't attempt to go beyond the limitations. That can be embarrassing.
There's a similar passage to this in Matthew 25, isn't it? And in this situation, though, there is a capacity difference, isn't it? There's a difference. We have different capacities. The guy that with five, was he measured against the guy with 10? Was he expected to do the same? That's a good point. Good point.
Each one did their best. I mean, the two guys did their best. One guy just got to the safe route.
Yep. Let's turn to Mark 6. How did Jesus train servants? And the way he trained them is the same way he's training us today. He rigs our circumstances. Like my son standing in that mess in the trailer. That was my opportunity. That was a godsend for me. In Mark 6, this is one of the few situations that's recorded in all four Gospels, the feeding of the 5,000. And let's just kind of go through that because it takes more than one Gospel to get the whole picture. Preceding the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus had commissioned the 12 on a missionary venture throughout the cities of the lost of the house of Israel. He himself stayed in Capernaum, which is up here on the northeast side and corner of the Sea of Galilee. And so while they were going about doing the thing that he asked him to do, cast out demons, preach about the kingdom and that sort of thing, he was performing miracles and healings and teaching in Capernaum. Well, when they got back, he said, "Boy, you guys had a great time, and I've already got the feedback around the country. So what we need to do now is to go across the lake and go in the hills and get some R&R together." That was the function. So they got in boats, went across, and from Capernaum, it wasn't that hard to walk around the north end of the Sea of Galilee, and so they end up here near Bethsaida on the other side, but it's on the northwest side. I'm sorry. This is east and this is west. So they're on the east side, and so it's kind of a short walk or a boat ride. And when they got there, here are these 5,000 people. Now here are the 12. They'd been on this exhaustive, exciting, emotionally charged situation with miracles, and they were excited about this. How excited were they? That's all they could talk about. They talked about so much. What did Jesus tell them to get excited about? Yeah, not that the demons were subject, but that their names were written. That's the most important thing, because this isn't yours. This isn't from. And now they're here to get R&R from all this excitement and all this exhaustion, and now there's 5,000 people, and they've got to feed them because there's not a Mickey D's close. And so, not only do they have to feed them, they have to organize them, they have to seat them, they have to find the food. They find the food, organize them, seat them. Now here they are, up and down the hill, serving these 5,000 men and their families. And you think it's finished now, don't you? No, there's still stuff to pick up, and we don't want to miss one crumb. So guess who's on the cleanup duty? They had to serve and they had to clean it up. And then what happened next to them? Jesus said, you guys get in the boat. I'll meet you in Capernaum in the morning. I'm going to dismiss the crowds. They're unruly. They're going to try to do something here that's not right. I'm going to dismiss them. I'm heading to the hills to pray. See you in the morning. So what happened to them on the way back across the lake? Easy time, stormy time, wind, and here these guys exhausted. The trip's not enough. The supper they had to do, the cookout, the whatever supper that you'd call that, and now they're rowing against the waves in danger, actually, of their lives, and Jesus kind of gets carried away with his prayer, gets behind, and knows he can't make it in time by the path and takes a shortcut, intending to pass them by, but they see him, and now we're in another situation. Is Jesus teaching them, these men, servanthood? He's teaching them the basics of the ministry, the basics of life. The basics of life is not preaching and teaching, it's serving people, it's taking care of people. R&R. How valuable is R&R? Well, it's valuable. There's a few things more valuable. Is anyone needing to stand? I'd lead you in singing, but I can't do that. If you feel like you need to stand at any time, just stand up. That's right. Stretch out, reach the ceiling. See if you can reach the ceiling. Stretch. Good stretching. Yep. Everybody get a good night of rest.
Finally got quiet at 7 o'clock when everybody woke up.
I see.
If you know what I mean.
Well, you must have been in the dorms.
Neither one of
them. Aren't the dorms great? We have a men's conference in April in Central Texas, and when we sign up for housing, we let them choose snore or non-snore. And in parentheses, liars may die in their sleep. Yeah. That's amazing how much better that is, actually.
Where does Dave Matson sleep?
Pardon me?
Where does Dave Matson sleep?
And he sleeps with the snores, I think. I don't know. Isn't he a swell guy? Yeah, he does. That's neat.
You know the film?
Yeah, I do. Verheiden's buddy and neat guy, plays the guitar and writes his own music, and it's great, deep stuff, good stuff. Here's the attitude. Here's the attitude. What passage am I going to talk about next? The attitude of the servant. What's Jesus? Pardon me?
Philippians 2.
Yeah, Philippians 2. What'd you say?
Luke 17:10.
I don't like 17:10. So likewise ye, isn't this what it says? So likewise ye, when ye shall have done all those things which you're asked, commanded, you say, we are unprofitable servants, for we have done that which was our duty to do. I don't like that verse. Don't like that one. What's Satan's attitude? Anybody know Satan's declaration of war, Isaiah 14:14? What's he doing there? I will ascend. I will go above. I will be like the Most High. That's the wrong attitude. And that's the attitude he met Adam and Eve in the garden with, wasn't it? And they bought into that attitude, and we all have ever since then, too. And here's the attitude that we need. Philippians 2:5. Have this mind among yourselves, or have this attitude among yourselves. Form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being born in likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee shall bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God. What are the attitudes? What are the things that we see about servanthood in that passage? What do you see? Definitely sacrifice, isn't it?
Obedience.
Obedience. Yes, sir.
Loss of ownership.
Loss of ownership. And loss of identity. You mentioned identity a while ago. He lost his original identity in that deal. Is that just for a while? Or does he remain in that form?
He had a choice.
All right, he volunteered for that, didn't he? He volunteered.
Finished.
There you go. He was a finisher.
You overcame the desire to be elevated before man.
Is that hard to do? Do we have biblical definitions for significance and security and honor, sense of honor, career? Those are tough ones, aren't they? That's kind of the core of what motivates us. The wrong definitions. We have the wrong definitions. I was immersed in my culture, my environment, my family, with wrong definitions of those things, wasn't I? And I don't guess it's anything new. It's what was established at the garden. In the garden. Yes, sir?
I think the other part of servanthood, at least in the Lord's view, is that the good news is temporary, like being a parent and turning to a grandparent. Things get better.
You know, that's true.
When God calls us to be servants, it's not an eternal call. You know, Jesus said in John that, you know, I no longer treat you as servants, I treat you as family. And I tell you what's going on.
Yeah.
So that even though we're called to be servants, that with eternity in view, we have a time-limited assignment. Servanthood, as we understand it in our human definition, isn't forever.
How many of you know what it's like to be a grandfather? I met your son, Kent. You're not a grandfather yet.
Not a
grandfather. Good. Just thought I'd ask. I didn't know what to do.
A friend of mine said we come into this world wet and naked, and then it gets worse.
It gets worse from there. You know what's the magic between a grandfather and a grandson? They both have a common enemy. That's right. That's special. One grandfather said to the other grandfather, "By showing you the pictures of my grandchildren lately," the other grandfather said, "No, sir, I want to tell you how much I appreciate that." Grandfathers, grandsons. Bruce?
I was just sitting here thinking a little bit, is that something I think we can look at, even in the parable of the talents and so forth, we can kind of spin a negative cast over that by saying, you know, don't exert yourself, or don't selflessness. And what happens is that we don't use the talents that God has given. So all of us have talents, all of us have gifts. And what God is just asking, use those for the benefit of others.
Yeah.
And so that servanthood is taking, whether it's intellectual or skills, or I was just reminded when Moses was building the tabernacle and so forth, it said that God specifically anointed men to be skillful with all manner of workmanship to build these articles and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
The temple. And they were servants in a sense of extending out what God had given them to serve others. And so that puts a little different dimension. Is where we get into trouble is when we look at another guy's gift and say, I'd rather do that than what I'm doing. And we begin to shortchange what God has done in our lives to aspire to something that we shouldn't be or couldn't be, or that kind of idea. And so there's that's where we get into trouble. We get into trouble if we serve what God has given us, gifts and talents and abilities.
Do we really have a chance of being servants? Is servanthood really a logical and a practical thing to aspire to? As Bruce was talking there, a servant is not an owner. Can we get excited and do our best about something we don't own? Or do we own it? How can we stay motivated? What can be our motivation?
The one thing to me about servanthood is, in order to be a servant, the hardest, or one of the hardest parts of being a servant, is being allowed, is allowing someone else to serve
you. Well, that is tough. Why is that?
Well, I think it's part of our manhood. Pride. We're raised to not depend on someone else. To be self-reliant. That's what, you know, kind of why the pioneers of this country were. They were self-reliant. They didn't, the mountain men went out in the mountains and relied on no one but themselves.
It's the American way.
Yeah, the American way. But you know, in my life, in my servanthood, trying to serve others, I find the most difficult part of the whole thing is allowing someone else to serve me.
Yeah. Can't say it was pride.
Yeah, I think pride goes back to that. I want to say something about what you said before. Can we be a servant? Can we ever be a servant? And that kind of thing. I disagree with some of the other comments that have been given. I think that we have no choice. If we are going to be a disciple of Christ, whether it's a good thing for us or not, whether we want to do that or not, or whether it's comfortable being a servant, if sanctification is becoming like Christ, and if Christ, in the epitome of Christ, was a servant, then we are going to be servants. Not only here, but we're going to be servants in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So God's purpose is to conform us to the image of His Son. And I may not be very far down the path, but I may as well come to enjoy it and begin to enjoy it and try to learn about it, because God is going to work in my life, if I'm a child of God, and even bring quite a bit of things into my life, like to build humility, to build patience, except He uses adversity. One of the things that He may use in our life is in my case, a customer or an employer or somebody else that's over me in a position of that, so that I can learn to be a servant. So I think we all are on the road to being the servants, and we will be a servant one way or the other. That's God's purpose.
I think what Kent said, I think it's just so hard that we don't like it. You know, Richard Foster said in the book that the flesh whines against service.
That's right.
But it screams at hidden service. We don't get recognized. People don't see us doing it. Like you were talking, you kicked it off earlier. I'm serving to get in good graces. I'm serving what my motivation is serving. I think it's just like we just don't like it. Our flesh rebels against the concept of serving. It's hard.
We want to be pampered.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
We want to get the glory. We really do.
We do.
I
think a lot of the motivation for servanthood comes towards how much love and respect we have for the person that we're serving, which ultimately should be God. But let me give the analogy that most of us all have a high regard for Gene Moore. And we know that Gene Moore is 71 years old and probably not as physically agile as some of us. So if Gene Moore's out front, he's got a flat tire, and it's raining and it's muddy, and he's out there struggling trying to change his tire,
Could I just see the hands of everyone who would love to change the entire forehead?
Yeah, two hands. Be great, wouldn't it?
That's because, but if that was a person who had on blue jeans and
like Mike,
tennis shoes, like, you know, like myself or whatever.
Your name's Mike too. That guy's named Mike.
Right.
Who's Mike?
The motivation would not be for both Mike.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
One of the areas I think that servanthood may be seen best in attitude is in nursing homes. I have found it real difficult to encourage people to think of themselves as valuable and decent at the end of their life when God has taken away their physical capacity, maybe to some extent their memory capacity. Going to serve in nursing homes or where people are physically and mentally incapacitated and try to convince them that they're still servants. That they have the value in life that God even considers them a servant.
Yeah.
Because they come to a point where they say, I'm not even worth that.
Yeah.
I'm not even valuable enough for God to consider me a servant because I have absolutely nothing to offer.
Amazing.
That's a level of servanthood that is
right.
Another level.
Somebody over here had something hot. Good.
Well, if we being made in God's own image, and God coming to earth in the form of Jesus Christ, who was the number one servant of eternity, I think it behooves us all to be more like Jesus and to be servants.
I want you just to take a second, and if you have to, in code form, I want you to write out what you get excited about. What's your passion? What is your passion in life? Is it sales or stitches, or is it raising crops? Is it flying? What's your passion? If you need to write it in code form so your neighbor can't see it, just do it. Maybe it may be sex. It may, I don't know what your passion is. Has everybody done that? Was it hard? You have to think twice. It should, if you've got a passion, it should be right there on the front. What is the great commandment? What is the great commandment? The Lord your God should be the center and focus of your passion. Having Him as your Lord and God with all your heart, soul, and mind, that should be your passion. If that's your passion, then you've got a chance to be a servant of His. Now, all of us do serve Him. God is not going to let us off the hook. We have to do that. We have to serve. None of us here got here by being irresponsible. Nobody at this conference, nobody would take time to go to a conference like this if they were totally irresponsible. And any responsible person is doing things for others. And so we're all in the process. But until you and I hold up our hands in unconditional surrender to the Lordship of Jesus Christ in our lives, that is the goal. And that at that point, pride, a working man's working definition of pride, it's coming out from under God's leadership in my life. Now I know, I can know when I'm walking by faith and when I'm walking in by my own agenda, just by reviewing everything that I do in light of Proverbs 2:3, 5, and 6. And what does that say? Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge Him. See, that's bringing everything under His leadership in my life. All my time, all my money, my marriage, my family. And interestingly, this book, God's Word, God's truth, speaks to all those areas so that I can be successful in His eyes in all those areas of my life, because every one of them are addressed clearly in this book. Would you agree with that? If I am willing to abandon my own agenda and bring everything that I've got under His leadership, and acknowledging that God is God, every one of us are going to do that, but getting Him in the center and focus, that's got to be a daily prayer. That's got to be something. And you ask Him, what obstacles are in the way right now? After all, what is the goal of sanctification? What is it that we hope to achieve? Look like Jesus? But what we're talking about is biblical freedom. That's another word we don't have a biblical definition for, freedom. See, my peer, people I grew up with, they were free because they burned their draft cards. Freedom is unhindered worship and service to Christ. No obstacles to the unhindered service and worship to Christ. That's freedom. That's biblical freedom. And sanctification, the process of sanctification, setting us apart, achieves freedom. We get free from ourselves, free from our agenda, free from these wrong definitions, wrong presuppositions about life, so that we have unhindered worship and service for Christ. Does that make sense? We have just a few minutes. We've got 15 minutes, and I want us to think through on what does this look like? What does biblical servanthood look like in different areas of our lives? For instance, what would it look like in my marriage? What would servanthood look like if I'm a servant in my marriage? Anybody want to make a suggestion? Picking up our clothes, picking up after ourselves, isn't it? Maybe picking up.
My wife doesn't care about the big things I do. She worries about the little things I do every day. That shows whether I can say, I can bring her flowers on Valentine's Day and take her out and say I love you, but she worries about how I treat her in the little things the next day. That's what makes the difference.
Yeah. Just picking up your own clothes.
Actually picking up her clothes.
Pick up hers?
You know, we're just being responsible to take care of ourselves. That's not being a servant. The servant is picking up after.
What about doing her laundry?
Yeah.
Or at least when she's folding clothes, help her with it or something.
Or washing the dishes.
We don't have to go.
Yeah, I may be a Christian, but I ain't no goody-goody.
Or even worse, go shopping. Oh, no.
We're getting the picture, aren't we? Yes, sir.
I'm all giving her respect and listening to what she has to say and responding to it like it is important.
Like it's important? Would that be service to her? How many words do women have to say a day? 5 million. Who in the world counted that anyway? I heard 300,000 or something. 532,861. How many do men have to say in a day? 10 words?
The actual studies they did at Harvard, men use 2,000 words, women use 5,000.
I'm glad we got it straight from Harvard. There it is, twice. 2.5 times as many. And we serve them by listening with interest, huh? That's one thing. Yeah, are we getting a picture on this deal? I'm going to ask you, after I get through, I'm going to go through 5 areas, and I'm going to ask you, so you might be thinking of something that you could take home and implement Sunday when you go home. And I'm going to ask us to take the last few minutes that you just turn with your friend. We're going to have small groups yet, and it's going to be twos, something we can handle, and pray for that person, this one thing. So be thinking. How about at work? How can you be a servant at work? Get your own coffee. Make your coffee for a change.
Don't respond. It's not in my job.
Do a part of the other guy's job. See, your daddy's a big daddy. Your daddy's strong. Your dad raised you right, too. Your dad made you strong. You can carry your load and part of his, too, just a little bit, can't you? You can help him along a little bit.
My dad used to have a saying, do what you're told to do when you're told to do it.
That's a help, isn't it? The navigators told me there's two kind of men we can't use. One that don't do what you tell them, and the others that do only what you tell them. And maybe that's why I'm not working for the Navs anymore. No, that's not right. Anything else at work?
I think we get kind of hung up again. We're talking about marriage and now work. You look at very specific tasks that you can do for somebody. The real bottom line is just becoming a person that's going to seek out the needs of everybody around you, wherever you are,
yeah,
and just meet those needs.
Needs. Meeting needs. Serving. Getting involved in the destiny of another. Yes, sir.
I had a spiritual leader one time that taught me some things about this. He and I'd go out to eat. There's no way I could ever get to the door first and open it for him.
Mm-hmm.
When we sat down to eat, he'd take the salt and the pepper shaker and put them on my side. One time we were out and we were eating fish and we needed ketchup, and he took the bottle of ketchup and took the top off it. I thought, he's going to use the ketchup for it. But he didn't. He wiped the top off and then he And there was no way, if we ever went to a place where you picked your tray up afterwards, there's no way I ever got to pick my tray up.
Mm-hmm.
Do it every time. And I said, well, that was conservative. Little things, but
you know, it's amazing in initiating things. I've always had it seem like it's almost like a plague, if you know what I mean. Guys that are in my living room are all smarter and faster and more efficient and quicker. In fact, one of them suggested I go see the movie Forrest Gump. Now, why would he tell me that? Because most of those guys have twice my IQ. I've got the IQ about room temperature, maybe a day. And in one bunch, I noticed when they came to my house, they left, it was a wreck. Just absolutely a wreck. Just, you know, whether it was equal containers or little packets, everything, just a mess. And then we graduated that bunch. And they're a good bunch, sweet bunch. They're all professionals. And they're used to people all doing that for them, see. They're used to crews coming in, cleaning up, and getting stuff ready. I mean, it just didn't cross their mind. Well, we start up with another bunch. And my house was overloaded with activity, so we had this deal going in somebody else's house. And I must have been walking incognito and in disguise, because I decided I'd walk in the spirit that night or something. And after the deal, I started carrying his chairs, and the hospitality among those folks, that was kind of a cultural no-no. You don't do that for other people, I guess. But he noticed that, and now that bunch is meeting in my living room, and they pick up just one little example of somebody taking a little initiative. It just makes a lot of difference. Just the whole tone of the thing. In the home with the kids, modeling serving. Serving the kids. My role as a father. What can I do to serve my kids?
Put the newspaper down and listen to what the other kids said to them in school today.
Give them a little of your own time and attention. Look them in the eye.
Play ball, build a model.
Go fish and take time, spend time with them.
Don't send your children back to them too early.
There's your grandfather.
I think about grandkids, you can send them home.
Yeah.
I think in my instance, maybe it's use my children a little less in there and other movies or their girls. Go get bad this or go do that.
Yeah.
How about love and respect your mother?
Oh, man. How about stay healthy? How about lose a little weight? That's what my son said.
Spend time teaching and disciplining. I just moved here from Michigan, and in Michigan, foster parents can't hit anybody. And it's interesting as I try to teach people to use non-corporal discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And part of servanthood is spending your time doing it, because if you don't always use the spanking method as your number one method, it's the fastest method possible, but doesn't spend any time teaching. To discipline, to teach your children.
Teach, train.
You have to serve them by giving them the time and spend the time teaching.
Don't just punish them, train them, teach them. Teach them to obey. Take the time. Take the time. Anything else? Yes, sir. Are you sure you want to say that? Sound like a man just getting into the teen years. Yeah, that's a tough time. Yeah. How about taking them with you, involving them in things that you do for others? In how about taking them with you when you're involved in ministry? How about asking them, which kid on your team would you like to lead to Christ this year? What can we do to facilitate that, make that an opportunity? There was a fellow that came to Christ in about 1974 or 5, I guess, or 6, and now here it is, 95, and he's just gone through a divorce, and during that ugly time, his 16-year-old daughter was killed in a head-on wreck. So I went to see him because it's just that's a real tight relationship there, and I just wept with him over that deal because it was just a tough thing. Well, in the process of just surrounding him and helping him go through that grief process, has been about 4 months. I'd bring my son along. I'm a real smart family planner because my youngest is young enough to be my grandson, so I'm getting practice on him, actually. But I bring him along, and now he has won their heart. He gave up a day off from school, a Monday, to help put a skirt around their trailer house. That you just don't know the awesome thing that does for them and what it does in his life. Take him along. How about with brothers and sisters in Christ / spiritual leadership? You may be a spiritual leader. One of the qualifications that God puts on leadership is serving. What are some specific things that you could do with some of your brothers and sisters in Christ? Is somebody right now in need of some kind of help, of relief? Take their kids and send them off on a little honeymoon. What can you do? Any ideas, any suggestions? How does this look in our relationship with others? Do not grow weary in well-doing. Yes, sir.
Come to this conference.
Yep, foot in the bill for a guy here. That's good. Finances. Great. Anything ringing a bell there you might do when you get back home. The last category I had was redemptive relationships. Folks that you don't know, that you know who are not Christians. There are ways you can serve them, serve him or her, them. What things can you do? What service can you perform? And have you all noticed this, that it's amazing when you do that, they're almost embarrassed because they've never had anybody do that before? Isn't that interesting? It almost embarrasses them. Sometimes you feel like maybe you did the wrong thing. Maybe he feels like he's been invaded here. Now what's he going to do in return? He's got to do something in return. Yes, sir?
I read an interesting article in one of the Disciple magazines a couple months ago. A group of men who go around and clean toilets. on Saturday, so they can they go out to strangers and people's homes and businesses, and they come up and say, "Can we clean your toilet for you?" And you think about the grungiest job there is going to do something like that, especially when it's not your own. And to go in there and to get the opportunity to go in there and not only just physically clean the toilet, but also to serve them in a way that opens up the opportunity to spread the gospel message.
Does. Yes, sir.
It was brought up earlier, and I think this is a good point to bring it up. Sometimes we have to allow the ones we serve to pay for the service. If we serve somebody and don't allow them to pay, we in essence make them a psychological debtor. And sometimes we have to be sensitive to allow them to pay for the service, not for our purpose, for their purpose, so that they
don't
go away saying, you know, I owe them something.
Right.
You help someone out of a snowbank from where I'm from, and the first thing you want to do is pay them.
Yeah, this gentleman mentioned it's hard to accept service from someone else. We don't want to be debtors in that way. Good. Do y'all have some things that you thought of that possibly that you could take back? I want us to use the minute that we've got. I think Chow's at noon yesterday.
Just something came to my mind. I went to visit John Crawford's hospital, and I have their insurance. And Helen Crawford was saying, you know, Neil, one of the best things that you can do for your wife is to have insurance. But when you're old like John and can't buy it, it's to get an annual physical.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you know, if we hadn't gotten annual physicals, John may have not found his blood clot. May not be with us this year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just a touch of love. A lot of men are just too cheap to go pay for a physical.
Stewardship of the body.
Stay healthy. Get healthy if you're not healthy, and stay healthy as long as you can. I want you right now to turn to somebody. And if you're too embarrassed to share what you're going to pray about, I want you to pray for the guy that you turn to. I want us just to pair up and pray just right quick for each other. So do that, and we're through for the day.